Today on the 21st, traveling with little ones can be challenging, and no one knows that better than parents themselves.
Audiobooks for kids have really grown in recent years. We also just love to listen to music and sing along and have fun with it in our car as well, went to keep the kids off the devices.
For those of you about to hit the road or board a plane for the Thanksgiving holiday, we've invited two Illinois dads. They host the Paternity Test comedy podcast to join us to share stories, advice, and encouragement. Plus, goose hunting in Illinois is in full swing. It's a tradition for many across the state.
It's a sport like baseball or basketball. I mean, it's something that people pass on to their kids.
We'll hear from a hunter, talk with the National Wildlife Federation also about how climate change may be causing fewer geese to migrate south, and ask, what does that declining population mean for the environment, the economy, and hunters? Plus, we meet the Chicago band Rat Boys. It's their music you're listening to right now. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Many people are hitting the road or catching a flight this next week as they travel to reunite with family or other loved ones for Thanksgiving. If you're a family with children, especially young ones, this is a lot easier than it sounds. We thought today we'd invite a few dads on to talk about the challenges of traveling with kids and share their stories and advice for everyone. Matt Barresi and Todd Jay are two of the hosts of the comedy podcast, The Paternity Test, and they're on the line with us now from Chicago and Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Matt, Jay, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Matt,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, Matt, let's start with you and welcome back to the 21st. You were on recently to talk about bathrooms and the challenges of bathrooms with kids. I feel like this is an even bigger category, right? Because you have a five-year-old daughter, but traveling involves not just being, say, a dad with a little girl in a bathroom, but a whole host of other challenges. Where have you gone with your daughter?
Well, we took our first flight in January of this year when she was four, and it was to Orlando, to Disney World. And it
how'd that
I
go?
Call it poorly. It went poorly.
It went poorly. Okay. In what way did it go poorly?
She and you know the difference I think between this and the horrors of taking your little girl to a public bathroom is that the problem is only your own in the public bathroom, but you have an audience of a couple of hundred people on an airplane, a hostile audience. And, the trip back was fine. I think she was worn out and sated from Disney Magic, but the trip there, her first flight, takeoff was lovely and delightful and full of squeals of excitement. And then she became just a rage monster, I think, from the pressure change in her ears and being cooped up on the plane. So she was just every bit the disaster that
here's always the question, right? I would think that lots of parents are nervous about this and they plan, and I wonder if you can share what you planned and then how maybe all of that probably fell apart if she just was, you know, not cooperating, right?
sure. Well, you know, when you look at when people discuss what to do with kids while traveling, I think there are three categories of plans, and they are ranging from in least to most efficacy and from least to most stridency. They are describe, distract, and dose. And by describe, I mean tell your kid what to expect so that they will be invested and excited and not frightened. And so we did that, but you know, depending on the age of your kid, if your kid is from between 1 and 5, they're really not a particularly rational animal. So that worked on takeoff because she wanted to see a plane take off. Distract is probably the moderate view, what most people are going to do, and probably the best thing you can do. And we brought an iPad, but it just wasn't enough. All the apps in the world didn't keep her occupied for the entire flight, nor did it overpower the bubble in her ears. And then the last one, dose, is to give your child Benadryl, which we don't subscribe to. It's probably the most effective thing, but it seems
just
a little...
to drug your kid, in other words. Right.
And potentially dangerous. Yeah. Yeah. So we told her what the flight was going to be.
Go ahead, Todd. Yeah.
I would not judge a parent who decided that that was going to be their best option. So I'll say, as a word of warning, if you're planning on having that as an option, try it at home first, because there is a side effect, a potential side effect with a percentage of all
could make them really hyper, right?
The paradoxical effect, where it can have the reverse effect, and then you're trapped in an aluminum tube, you know, with a kid who is uncontrollable and loud and you know, uncontrollable. So do try it at home if you think that might be an option for you, an hour before bedtime, see what happens, and then you know whether or not that might be an option for you on a plane. Don't have it just and decide to do it on the fly.
That's good advice. Okay, so everyone who's listening can join the conversation. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to us, 21STShow, to share your experience of traveling with kids. If you don't have kids and you want to share your experience as well, that's fine too. Matt, you said there was a hostile audience on the plane. I fly all the time, and I don't have children. I have lots of nieces and nephews, so I'm always sort of the interested observer in all of this. And I think because I fly all the time, I have maybe a different perspective. But when you say hostile audience, were people really hostile, like they were articulating their hostility to you, or were they just glaring at you, which is, I guess, also articulating it?
Well, I've been, I think before having a child, I was a hostile flyer. Like when a child would have a tantrum on a plane, I would judge that parent. I would even say things like, what can you do about that child? So it's karmic that my daughter is a terrible traveler now.
Okay.
Because I realized that, you know, there's no ethical ground that you can stand on to say that children should not be allowed to fly. And there's no way to really control them on a flight within reason. So I think that people, and I understand they're business traveling, they may be traveling, they might be stressed out. But there's no reason to be mean to parents when their kids are having a tantrum. Because they
and have people, were people mean to you when she was?
Well, I think the real secret to flying with children is always fly to Orlando and only fly to Orlando.
Because it was the whole plane full of kids having meltdowns?
And all of them. Everyone was melting down. Everyone was tiny. So no one was judging because it was a comically disastrous flight.
Well, and Todd, let me ask you this. Todd, your kids are older, 11 and 14, but I've never actually seen this happen, but I have heard of stories. One of my producers and I, we were talking about this, parents who get on a plane and they pass out like notes or earplugs or say like, sorry in advance if I cry, like a note written by the baby ostensibly. Do you think that's a way to go? I think earplugs, my position on this is, I think if you are a traveler, I always carry earplugs with me. I'm always prepared. I just put them in as soon as I get on a plane. I don't care if I'm sitting next to a baby or someone who's not going to cry. I just don't want to hear anyone. But
well, I feel like the preemptive apology goodie bag kind of set, you know, I feel like you're setting yourself up to say, to tell the people around you,
my child isn't going to behave.
So
right.
You're just, yeah, I'm planning on my child being a monster, so you're just going to have to deal with it. Here's a fun-sized Twix to get you through it. So I'm not a fan of those. I feel like what's more effective is to, as long as people see that you are engaged and trying and doing your best and not just giving up or not just, you know, trying to pay attention to your phone or magazine and letting your child kick the seat in front of you, I think if they see that you are you have a very genuine effort and you've had a plan and you're trying your best, they're less likely to judge you and you know, maybe they'll even be more apt to assist. I mean, I'm one who, if I'm sitting across from a child, I'm all for distracting them, making faces. If it's a small child, if I can engage them for a couple of minutes, that might be the 2 minutes that parent needs to kind of reset and reboot, you know, and that short little break might get them ready to have another activity ready for their child. So if I'm there and I can be useful, I will be. I'm not going to.
Okay,
you know,
so here's my question about that, right? Because I think it's different for me because I'm a woman, but I also, I feel like some people might be nervous about engaging a stranger's kid, right? And I feel like, do you have to ask the parent? Is it just a question of you say hi to the parent when they sit down with the kids so they know that you're not hostile? If you're someone who doesn't have kids, because I think there probably are people who would want to, and I think this is a generational thing too, because I feel like a lot of older people feel like they don't have these boundaries and they'll just play with someone else's kid. But I feel like if you're younger, you might be a little more nervous about that. So what would you suggest would be a respectful way for someone who doesn't have kids to like interact with your kid on a plane?
Well, I think if you say hi to them when they first get on, maybe ask a question about the child, how old, you know, what's their favorite thing, you know, something like that. But then, you know, the interactions, obviously, you want to be careful about. You don't necessarily want to be touching or grabbing or anything like that. But if you can be making silly faces across the aisle, and if you can, you can kind of read, you know, how the parent feels about it. And you, if you want to ask permission, if you can interact with them, that's fine too. But I just feel like that initial interaction before things get started, just by saying hi and having a nice friendly greeting, kind of lets them know, hey, I'm on your side.
Right, right. And then, so let's go back to the describing. Matt, can you talk about that? What sort of, like, you think for people who haven't flown, what's in the description phase if you're going to go from maybe under 5 years old? What kind of things do you say? How do you prepare a kid for, we're getting on a plane, we're going on a plane for the first time, we're going to the airport, those sorts of things?
Sure. Well, probably they're excited about the notion of flying because airplanes are part of every children's book and cartoon. And so they understand that planes fly and that people are on them. So they're probably already there. What they probably don't understand is that there's other people on the plane, that they're going to be on it for a while, that they are not going to understand about the discomfort in their ears. And when the plane actually starts to take off, I think they may find that it's a little more thrilling or alarming than they had anticipated as far as being tipped back and moving quickly. So to describe all those things and do it repeatedly, because these are teeny little brains and they're trying to work things out. So for, you know, months ahead of the flight, if you know you're going to take a flight, to keep revisiting the idea of the flight and walking them through the steps, getting them to tell you what they know is going to happen on the flight so that they understand and can be excited about it, is going to help them from anything you can turn down the emotional temperature on the flight, because you're nervous, they're nervous, the people around you are nervous, and you're just trying to stop conflict from happening or stop a match being struck.
Right.
And don't forget to include the pre-flight descriptions as well, because you got to talk to them about standing in line, about
right,
going
security lines,
security, and how you're going to describe that, because they're going to see a lot of people in uniforms with, you know, holsters and people getting scanned. And so you want to make sure that you describe that process also, because that can be a scary thing as you're, you know, a smaller child surrounded by adults in this line moving slowly. So be sure you're including all that pre-flight business with them as well when you're talking about it.
Let me ask you guys a question about that, especially pre-flight. We were talking about this morning in the office. I feel like, and I've had family members who have lost children at the airport, so I feel like this is in the context of that. I feel like you never see the leashes on kids anymore at airports. I feel like that's not a thing. Or do people not do that anymore? Or how do you kind of, that's part of, frankly, the anxiety of any family traveling, is you're worried about losing your kid or kid not keeping up. There's a lot of people around. There are a lot of strangers. How do you kind of handle that, especially if they're little?
That's an excellent question.
I was
because,
never a leash.
You not only have children, you have bags.
Right, right. Yeah. You have bags and a child, right.
Mm-hmm.
And we would always kind of put a child in charge of some kind of a bag, something that would give them a job to do and that helped them kind of stay focused. And then we were able to, you know, if that meant we had one less bag to roll, maybe then we can.
Oh, Todd, it looks like we lost you there. Matt, were you saying that you have never been a leash person?
Oh, no, we had a leash.
You did have a leash. Okay.
Yeah. But children are getting stronger, I think. It's the hormones.
They're getting stronger.
Yeah.
Okay, so
we had a very small window where the leash worked for our child because she caught on to the fact that she was on a leash and that was that.
So
I don't know if leashes just didn't work as well as people hope they would, or if it's just become a social stigma to have your child on a leash. But I don't see the leashes anymore either.
Oh, so you think maybe it's a social stigma? Todd, we're back. Do you think there's a social stigma now? You can't put a leash on your child anymore. Is that what it is?
I think it does look. It looks like you're taking the easy way out. Like, I'm just going to tie the child up, and then no matter what, I can pay attention to anything else. I do think there's a stigma to it. As soon as you say the word leash, you know, a child on a leash, it just sounds...
Right. Like, there's probably another name for it, but that's what I call it. I don't know what the name is. Maybe they call it, like, child harness or something like that. But okay, so we've got a couple minutes before we have to take a break. I wanted to ask you, move to the second part about distraction and what tips you guys have for, especially for a plane, but then I think this also applies to a car travel. What kind of tools do you have for, oh, by the way, my producers are telling me the official term is child safety harness, even though no one uses that, right? Yeah, okay. What kind of tools do you have for distracting, apart from an iPad?
My biggest tip about distraction is to is to have distractions that you can space out. So it might be something that you maybe go to the dollar store and find a number of things that you don't let your child pick out, because as soon as they know that they're available, they're going to want all of them at the same time in quick succession. So I'm a big proponent of having things ready, you know, that you can pull out as soon as you see the tide starting to turn, and maybe it's something new. You know, children love cheap toys. You know, it's something you can get at a dollar store that you could even throw away after the trip is over. But if you want to space that stuff out, don't let them know everything that you have with you, so that you can always kind of give them a surprise. And so the other thing about things to do on travel and plane, I'm also a big fan of what I would call the clean crafts. So things like the Color Wonder markers that only write on the paper that you have, or the Magna Doodle, so they can do a craft without making a big mess or drawing on somebody's suitcase or anything like that.
Right, right. That's good. Clean crafts, spacing it out. Matt, how about you?
Well, and this is where we went wrong. We went right to our best option.
You went to your failsafe right away. Okay.
Yeah, and that was a huge mistake, because if a fully animated, cartoon episode of Duck McStuffins doesn't do the trick, you can't go back. You can't say, how about a craft? Like, it's done. And you barely left the runway. So we needed more of those small things, and we needed to lay them out in some kind of order. Because really, I think you want your last thing to be diving into a cartoon. And I think that it is important to not die on the hill of your house rules as far as screen time or sitting still. Like, it's a new experience. It's a scary experience. It's a lot of waiting. And, for an adult, when you're bored at the airport, you get work done, or you noodle on your phone, or you read, or you...
Matt, let me stop you there. We're just going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Matt and Todd, co-hosts of the Paternity Test podcast. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Matt Barresi and Todd Jay. They're co-hosts of the comedy podcast, The Paternity Test, Chicago, Montgomery, Illinois dads who've been talking to us about traveling during the holiday season. If you have tips, you can tweet them to 21st Show, 21st Show. You can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. Matt, you were talking before the break about rules and parents and kind of maybe being a little more lenient about the rules. And I want to throw another thing out there for everybody. News this morning that some airport workers at O'Hare have voted to authorize a possible strike. So there may be a strike next week at O'Hare. The timing of that is not clear. It's some airport workers. It's all sort of very up in the air now. But I was just thinking that could possibly be in the works next week. There's always travel delays. Wednesday is the busiest travel day of the year in this country. So I guess it's a good reminder maybe about being prepared for delays, but also kind of being flexible about rules. What do you think, Matt?
Well, that's the thing is travel is on a good day, travel is very boring. I mean, maybe not, driving past scenes you've never seen, but like there's a lot of hurry up and wait in travel. And for an adult, that can be fine because we have an interior life and we can meditate on our failings or whatever we do when we have a lot of time to ourselves. But a child has no memories, has no work to think about, and they're very, very bored, and perhaps they should be. So if you have screen time limits, or you wouldn't normally give them a bag of new toys, or you wouldn't normally, run up and down the hallway of the concourse of the airport, I think you need to be a little more lenient for their sake when you're in these really stultifying scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Todd, what about you? I mean, when we're thinking also, we've been talking a lot about air travel. A lot of people are going to be driving, especially Thanksgiving. Lots of people are driving across the Midwest, across the country to visit family. Your kids are older, so they're 11 and 14. Is it a lot easier now when they're older? You're just kind of with their devices plugged in with their own headphones or whatever in the car, or how do you handle that?
It has gotten easier in that way, in that they're a little more distracted with their own devices and they can entertain themselves a little more. But you do get a lot more of the, are we there yet? I need to stop for the bathroom. Even as much as with smaller children. I think with smaller children, you can kind of regiment them a little bit more in some of that and some of those stops. But we started driving. We drove once a year for the last 13 years from here to Florida. So we've made that trip with our children as infants, as toddlers, and every age, you know, from there. And we've tried a couple of different methods. We've tried the overnight drive, you know.
Right, yeah, because it's about 20 hours, depending on where you're going in Florida. That's a long drive.
Sure, we've driven straight through when we were young and full of energy and thought we could do that. And that was semi-successful. The thing I will say about that, if you're trying any kind of nighttime driving where you expect your child to sleep, make sure that you're leaving, you know, when you leave your destination, you've got a full tank of gas and an empty bladder, because you don't want to get an hour in after they fall asleep and realize, oh, we got to stop for gas or I need to use the restroom. Because as soon as you stop that car, that motion, the stopping of the car motion is likely to wake them up, or you're opening the door. And once they're up, they tend not to fall back asleep. So if you want to get a chunk of driving done while they're sleeping, be prepared, and be prepared to not stop and get as much as you can. If you can get 300 miles without stopping while they're sleeping, that's a big win right there.
That's a good point. When kids are older, I feel like we've spent a lot of time talking about sort of negative things about travel, but I wonder if either of you have great stories or good stories you want to share about travel, or just encouragement that you want to offer people who are nervous about it.
Well, I'd say, you know what, be open to the delays. And be ready to kind of do something out of the ordinary. So if you wouldn't normally stop and have McDonald's for lunch, but you find one that has, say, an indoor playland, and maybe the weather's not great and you're in a long drive, give them that extra 20 minutes or so to get some energy out and play. We found that a lot of rest stops now, while we're driving on longer trips, have some playgrounds, and we've done it ourselves where we've decided to we'll bring a ball and something, and we'll play with them, and the kids love that, and it breaks up the drive. They get some time with you guys in an unusual place. You play a couple of games. It might mean that your drive, you might get to your destination a half hour later, but they're fun moments, and it makes the drive better for the kids.
Yeah, thanks for that, Todd. Matt?
We love to share music with one another when we're traveling, because it's time, it's that kind of wound down time with just the family, whether we're sitting in the airport or driving in a car. And, you know, if you live in Illinois, there's a lot of driving. It's a big state with a lot of expanses. So whether it's with headphone splitters or in the car, we have a deal where we'll trade back and forth, a grown-up song, one of Viva's songs. And so if she wants to hear some kid music that she likes, she can, but then she'll get introduced to our music. So she'll, you know, all of us like the Beatles. Everybody likes the Beatles. So it's a chance to, you know, if you're a music buff, if you're in music or education, it's a chance to work on harmony and learn about it. But it's also a chance for them to learn, get a bigger musical palette, and then for them to tell you what music they like.
I guess you can work on harmony in a car. Have you ever done that in an airport, Matt?
I guess they would rule it out.
Last question. Are either of you guys traveling for the holidays?
We're lucky enough to get to stay home this year. We've done our share of traveling, and now we've started to invite the family this way. So but we are flying to California over Christmas, and that's going to be a new thing for us, is Christmas travel. So I haven't done that before.
We'll be driving from the north side of Chicago to Coal City, Illinois, south of I-80. So that's 80 minutes on a good day on Thanksgiving. We could imagine we'll get the whole White Album and Revolver and Abbey Road in.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks to Matt Barresi and Todd Jay. You can catch their comedy podcast. It's called The Paternity Test, available wherever you can find podcasts. Thanks, guys. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
You. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Hunting season is in full swing all throughout Illinois, but fewer Canadian geese are finding their way to southern Illinois in recent years. Experts say part of the reason might be because of climate change. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about that with a representative from the National Wildlife Federation. But first, we spoke with Dale Beatley, a co-owner and president of Gander Hill Hunting Club in southern Illinois near Pinckneyville, about how important goose hunting is to the economy and culture for many families in southern Illinois.
It's a sport like baseball or basketball. I mean, it's something that people pass on to their kids if they've did it. If you golf or something, you know, what do you teach your children how to do? You teach them how to golf, you know, because that's something you've always did and you've enjoyed.
Dale also shared with us a little bit of his slow cooker recipe for how he cooks geese he's hunted.
I use some apples in a crock pot. I put about 8 breast pieces in there for about 6 hours. And with some seasoning, then it crumbles, and I make it into barbecue. The apple takes the wild taste out of just about anything, you know, game-wise. It, you know, it puts a sweet taste into it.
Dale's been hunting his entire life since he was a boy, but what he's noticed in recent years, compared to when he hunted in the 70s and 80s, is that there's been a consistent decline in the number of Canadian geese reaching southern Illinois, and he thinks climate change might be to blame.
There's clubs all through the southern Illinois here, and they're hunting clubs to where basically Canadian geese had been the, you know, the big draw to get everyone to come to southern Illinois. And now, I mean, there's people come, and they still hunt. They hunt a few geese, and we shoot some speckled belly geese, and they shoot ducks and snow geese. But Canadians, is just due to the weather and the warmer winters, has found that they don't have to come to southern Illinois.
That's Dale Beatley. He's co-owner and president of Gander Hill Hunting Club near Pinckneyville in southern Illinois. We wanted to explore a little bit more about what Dale said about migrating birds and climate change. That's why we're joined now by Frank Selasi from the National Wildlife Federation. He's the manager of Great Lakes Regional Campaigns. Frank, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, we just heard Dale mention he suspects climate change is the reason there just aren't as many Canadian geese migrating down to southern Illinois. Is he right about that?
Well, climate change is certainly a contributor to the stress that Canadian geese and other species are facing from human impacts, whether it's from fragmentation of landscapes, pollution, urbanization. Climate is a risk multiplier, and it is staying warmer longer in not just Illinois but also up in Canada.
What do you mean when you say risk multiplier? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, migratory birds rely on habitat, in order to reproduce and survive and travel. In the prairie pothole region, which includes, the Great Plains, in southern Illinois, there's been a loss of wetlands and habitat. That's what we call fragmentation. And so for the habitat that's left, it's more susceptible to changes that come from climate change, such as increasing episodes of very heavy rainfall creates erosion and degrades the habitat for these waterfowl and game birds.
And Frank, when you're saying also, mm-hmm. when I'm thinking about that, when you're saying like a decrease in wetlands, a decrease in mm-hmm. habitat, is that because of our building, because of construction, human construction, or why are we seeing that?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing changes in agriculture, suburbanization. That type of development fragments wetlands, not just Illinois, but many places around the Great Lakes and the Great Plains have seen a loss in wetlands. And so climate aggravates that situation by making the habitat that's left even more treacherous for migratory waterfowl and game species. It's true not just in Illinois, but also in Canada. The Canadian boreal forests are only really 20% protected up there. What we've seen is because of increasing temperatures and increasing very heavy rainfall, some species of game birds up there have been cut in half.
Wow. So we are seeing decline in overall population for different waterfowl, then it sounds like you're saying, different waterfowl.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And then are there other reasons also that are leading to a decline in the population? Is it a possibility in terms of when we're talking particularly about fewer geese reaching southern Illinois, is overhunting a concern? What other things are you seeing?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't call overhunting a concern. I mean, you know, National Wildlife Federation has represented generations of hunters and anglers and wildlife enthusiasts. So we got our start in the 1930s. And are comprised of hunting clubs, gun clubs, fishing clubs all over the country. And you know, what we're seeing is an impact of climate change on game species, really across the country. You know, one of the other examples of climate impacting and adding stress to these game species is that the very heavy rainfall and the changing temperature conditions allows for invasive species that push out such things as smartweed and millets, which are food sources for ducks in the remaining wetlands. And so, not only is their habitat disrupted, but some of their food sources are being pushed out as well.
And, you know, Frank, as you said, you all, the National Wildlife Federation, you know, has represented and worked with hunting clubs across the country. I'm wondering, we've been talking about the environmental effects, or I guess maybe the environmental causes of geese and the population. But I wonder, you know, we heard Dale a little bit of his story from Pinckneyville, how much of, he's saying how much it's part of his culture and his family traditions to do this. I mean, what impact are you seeing in different communities across the country who I imagine are experiencing, it's not just Pinckneyville, like we're seeing this in different communities across the country. What kind of impact are we seeing?
Sure. Well, we certainly respect the tradition of, you know, passing on hunting and sportsmen's traditions to children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It's a great heritage and one that, you know, we pledge to defend. Like you said, it's not just Southern Illinois and the Great North Woods of Minnesota, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and in New England. We're seeing the warmer winters allowing pests such as ticks to live and survive these warmer winters, which are devastating young moose. There's been a dramatic decline in the moose population across the Great North Woods. It's resulted in the cancellation of moose hunts and candidly just a great concern about the future of that species going forward. What else you're seeing in you know, northern states is the diminishment of opportunities to ice fish.
Right, so those are right, not just cultural, I imagine, but economic impacts as we're thinking about
huge
tourism.
Economic impacts.
Yeah.
I mean,
so, Frank, to that point, we just have about a minute left, and I just want to ask what you think can be done. I mean, what would you like to see done to protect geese, other waterfowl? Where are we at with that?
Sure. Well, on the mitigation side, you know, we would like to see, and we continue to call on federal policymakers and state policymakers and businesses and citizens act on climate change. You know, the transition to clean, renewable, sustainable forms of energy is something that folks should embrace. And for communities that are impacted by that transition away from fossil fuels, there should be support for that transition. We also believe in support adaptation and resilience training for wildlife managers so that they can factor in the impacts of climate change on, professional wildlife management in state DNRs and other types of, management agencies.
Yeah, thanks for that, Frank. Sounds like lots of things to be done with this. So I want to thank Frank Selassie with the National Wildlife Federation, manager of Great Lakes Regional Campaigns, for joining us. Thanks, Frank. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. We've got a musical act coming up next. You're listening to The 21st.
Plants and airplane paths, and we would fall into
Chicago band Rap Boys. They're playing this Monday night at the Hungry Brain Bar in Chicago. Julia Steiner, who sings and plays guitar in the band, is on the line with us now from her home in Oak Forest, Illinois, just south of Chicago. Hey, Julia, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Hey, yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So you're back home in Chicago. You've been out on tour on the road with Rap Boys for the past few months. Where did you guys go?
Yeah, we started out, we did 40 days over in Europe. So that was a pretty far-ranging trip. We started out in Eastern Europe, like Czech Republic and Poland, made our way to Spain and, I don't know, all sorts of places.
Wow.
It was great. We got to go back to Ireland, where I used to live for a bit. And, yeah, so we were there for about 5 weeks and then came back and did another month down south to Florida and along the East Coast.
So it sounds like, was this the biggest, biggest tour for you guys?
It was, yeah, it was by far. Before this, the longest trip that we had done was about a month. I kind of told the guys, like, if we can do this, we can do anything. So,
well, and I think about that, and I think about the work that you've done, and looking back on the past 2 months, now that you've been back, what was it like to see Rap Boys in this project go from you writing music with Dave Sagan, who's your guitarist, in college, to playing all over Europe and the U.S.?
It was pretty awesome. I mean, in Europe, not a ton of people knew us over there, but it was cool. A few of the shows, people were singing along to the songs, and in the States, it was great. The part of the trip that was along the East Coast was with a couple really great bands that have pretty established fan bases, so we got to piggyback off of that. They're Sorority Noise and Free Throw. Those shows especially were very successful, and a lot of them sold out, so that was cool.
I'm speaking with Julia Steiner. She sings and plays guitar in the band Rap Boys. Their first full-length album is called AOID, came out last summer. Let's take a listen to 1914, which is a song off of your debut album. Was 1914, a song off the debut album AOID from the Chicago band Rap Boys. Singer and guitarist Julia Steiner is with us on the line. So, Julia, I have a question for you because our production staff was talking and we were listening to your music. And as I think every time we do when we're thinking about a band and we're thinking about what genre they fit into, I heard this term, which I've never even heard before, post-country. Is that a thing? And is that a label people apply to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely don't want to claim that I invented that, but it kind of popped in my head one day and started just like kind of embraced that moniker and gave it to some of my friends who I think make music in a similar vein. I just kind of think of it as music that embraces the storytelling tradition of classic country music, like Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, not really country music that's being made today, which I think is a little more closer aligned with, I guess, like pop music, but just music that has similar elements as like classic country music, but gives it a slightly more indie spin.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as storytelling goes, and also just like musically with certain inclinations toward like acoustic guitar work and we didn't really use pedal steel or lap steel, but it's like slide guitar, certain little nuances that just give them kind of a modern twist.
Okay. And you grew up in Kentucky,
so yeah,
right?
I kind of insist on that.
Yeah. So you grew up.
Yeah.
I wonder if some of that, if the artists that you grew up with, the sound that you were surrounded by, like, do you feel like that maybe is a little bit also influential in all of this and kind of where this whole idea of post-country comes from?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Like, growing up, the woman who kind of watched me and my siblings while my parents were at work is from Tennessee. Her name's Karen. And she definitely introduced or just kind of bathed us in, like, a lot of, like, spiritual country music and even... And maybe, I mean, and other stuff too, like Loretta Lynn, and she listened to tons of Dolly Parton. I mean, I definitely, like, am not an authority on that type of music, but I think maybe just subconsciously being surrounded by that kind of stuff as a kid, like, gave me that preference or, like, helped me love really good, like, storytellers and songwriters. So,
well, and when I think about the storytelling that's in your songs, it's sort of... blending styles, but as you said, kind of you're throwing in personal life stories. Sometimes there's historical references. How do you start with the narrative of your lyrics?
Yeah, it kind of depends. There's like two different scenarios which usually end up happening. The first is, and I heard Jeff Tweedy kind of talking about this in the Song Exploder podcast recently, but the idea of like, almost free writing with your voice, where you'll just be playing an instrument and kind of singing along to it and recording like the gibberish that comes out. But then sometimes you'll subconsciously sing something very interesting, like actual words and phrases that make sense and in a weird way. Or you'll just sing sounds and kind of try to make words out of those sounds. So that it's almost like a subconscious, like harnessing the subconscious thing. So that's one way. The other way would be approaching a melody that's in your head with an idea of like, I want to tell the story about this time that we went to the zoo when I was a kid and I like fell into the turtle enclosure or whatever. Like, I don't know, something like funny and interesting that you'd like to share with people. So like sometimes there's like an intentional, the story behind it. But then other times it's kind of just like taking what comes out of you and turning it into a story.
You mentioned Jeff Tweedy, and I'm thinking about Wilco and you having a band in Chicago. And I wonder how much you think Chicago's scene, music scene, Rap Boys was kind of incubated on this in the south suburbs of Chicago. And I just wonder, when you're thinking about the indie music scene in Chicago, how much of that has played a role in the music that you guys are creating and the sound that you're also creating?
Been huge. I mean, the project started out as just the two of us, me and Dave, and it kind of still is at the core, but you know, we've been lucky to play with dozens of really, really talented musicians around the city. And like, it's cool because the songs, like a lot of the songs that we still play live, we have been playing for a long time and they're like old, but it's cool because every time we play them with like a different cast around us, they sound different and new. So, I mean, that's all. All of the scene really is just people living in the same place, creating stuff together. So, I mean, the people that we've gotten to meet, you know, specifically, like I moved here after I graduated from college, and it was kind of a no-brainer because there were just so many interesting people who make so much cool music, and I just needed to be near them. I was sick of just being internet friends.
So, is that what you was going to say?
It's been huge.
When you think about, when you relocated here, was it because of the music scene, or was it you were here and then you started making music?
Oh, no, it was completely because of this. We had been a band when I was still living in Kentucky, and like during the summers, it was pretty rough because, you know, we would, we didn't play very many shows, but we would play maybe three in the summer, and we weren't really touring at that point, but you know, I would drive up from Kentucky. So it was like a 6-hour drive.
Yeah, that's a long drive, right?
Yeah, like I kind of just realized after college, like, hey, I have the freedom now to like choose to be close to this. And so we could actually try to play more because I knew that I liked playing live. But I was just really curious to see how much I liked it. So,
and do you think that all right? Do you think your tour being in Europe and being in other, you know, being along the East Coast, does that? Do you think that affects being in all of those different environments? How do you think that's going to affect your album that you're working on right now?
Well, it definitely gives us. I mean, the more music we hear every night, the more we kind of hone in on how we want it to sound. So it'll definitely make it more rich in that way. I mean, one of the songs specifically on this new record is kind of a mishmash of stories about our time on the road. So it's kind of finished, but I almost want to make it a song where I just keep adding verses over the years, like make it like a ridiculous Bob Dylan song, like 10 minutes long. Being on the road, definitely, it just gives you so many stories. Like, that's the thing, you know, when you're home doing a similar kind of routine thing every day, obviously your things are going to happen and you'll come away with, you know, interesting tales to tell, but that just becomes intensified by a million when you're waking up in a new place every day and like meeting people you've never met. And I'm naturally kind of shy, so I didn't know if that would be a thing that I would enjoy, but I'm like kind of addicted to it at this point.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Let's end by taking a listen to Not Again. This is a song you did with Dowsing from Chicago. Rap Boys is playing Monday night at the Hungry Brain Bar in Chicago. Hey, Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All the little faces that make up the sky will fall in and replace us when we die. Take it from me, I am alive. Or if not, at least this feels right to be tied. Coffee's sick in space and my car drives itself down Central Park.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, all of the information about how to get in touch with us is at our website, www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.